Even though it burned to the ground when the boiler exploded, it wins. If I don't drink, I go crazy. He thought, all that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. He was still tightening the cap and loosening it when Billy Freeman, who had awakened early with the vague, alarmed sense that something was wrong, found him.
Are you going to drink that, Dan? Or just keep jacking it off?
Drink it, I guess. I don't know what else to do. So Billy told him.
20.
Casey Kingsley wasn't entirely surprised to see his new hire sitting outside his office when he arrived at 8:15 that morning. Nor was he surprised to see the bottle Torrance was holding in his hands, first twisting the cap off, then putting it back on and turning it tight again. He'd had that special look from the start, the 1,000-yard Cappy's Discount Liquor Store stare. Billy Freeman didn't have as much shine as Dan himself, not even close, but a bit more than just a twinkle. On that first day, he had called Kingsley from the equipment shed as soon as Dan headed across the street to the municipal building. There was a young fella looking for work, Billy said. He wasn't apt to have much in the way of references, but Billy thought he was the right man to help out until Memorial Day. Kingsley, who'd had experiences, good ones, with Billy's intuitions before, had agreed. I know we've got to have someone, he said. Billy's reply had been peculiar, but then Billy was peculiar. Once, 2 years ago, he had called an ambulance 5 minutes before that little kid had fallen off the swings and fractured his skull.
He needs us more than we need him, Billy had said.
And here he was, sitting hunched forward as if he were already riding his next bus or bar stool, and Kingsley could smell the wine from 12 yards down the hallway. He had a gourmet's nose for such scents, and could name each one. This was Thunderbird, as in the old saloon rhyme. What's the word? Thunderbird. What's the price? 50 twice. But when the young guy looked up at him, Kingsley saw the eyes were clear of everything but desperation. Billy sent me. Kingsley said nothing. He could see the kid gathering himself, struggling with it. It was in his eyes. It was in the way his mouth turned down at the corners. Mostly it was the way he held the bottle, hating it and loving it and needing it all at the same time. At last Dan brought out the words he had been running from all his life. I need help. He swiped an arm across his eyes. As he did, Kingsley bent down and grasped the bottle of wine. The kid held on for a moment, then let go.
You're sick and you're tired, Kingsley said. I can see that much. But are you sick and tired of being sick and tired?
Dan looked up at him, throat working. He struggled some more, then said, You don't know how much.
Maybe I do.
Kingsley produced a vast key ring from his vast trousers. He stuck one in the lock of the door with Fraser Municipal Services painted on the frosted glass. Come on in. Let's talk about it.
Chapter 2. Bad Numbers. 1. The elderly poet, with the Italian given name and the absolutely American surname, sat with her sleeping great-granddaughter in her lap and watched the video her granddaughter's husband had shot in the delivery room 3 weeks before. It began with a title card, Abra Enters the World. The footage was jerky, and David had kept away from anything too clinical, thank God. But Conchetta Reynolds saw the sweat-plastered hair on Lucia's brow, heard her cry out, I am! When one of the nurses exhorted her to push, and saw the droplets of blood on the blue drape. Not many, just enough to make what Chetta's own grandmother would have called a fair show. But not in English, of course. The picture jiggled when the baby finally came into view, and she felt goose flesh chase up her back and arms when Lucy screamed, She has no face! Sitting beside Lucy now, David chuckled. Because, of course, Abra did have a face. A very sweet one. Chetta looked down at it as if to reassure herself of that. When she looked back up, the new baby was being placed in the new mother's arms. 30 or 40 jerky seconds later, another title card appeared. Happy Birthday, Abra Rafaela Stone.
David pushed stop on the remote.
You're one of the very few people who will ever get to see that, Lucy announced in a firm take-no-prisoners voice. It's embarrassing.
It's wonderful, Dave said. And there's one person who gets to see it for sure, and that's Abra herself.
He glanced at his wife sitting next to him on the couch. When she's old enough, and if she wants to, of course.
He patted Lucy's thigh, then grinned at his granny-in-law, a woman for whom he had respect but no great love.
Until then, it goes in the safe deposit box with the insurance papers, the house papers, and my millions in drug money.
Concetta smiled to show she got the joke, but thinly, to show she didn't find it particularly funny.
In her lap, Abra slept and slept. In a way, all babies were born with a call, she thought, their tiny faces drapes of mystery and possibility. Perhaps it was a thing to write about. Perhaps not. Concetta had come to America when she was 12 and spoke perfect idiomatic English, not surprising since she was a graduate of Vassar and professor, now emeritus, of that very subject. But in her head, every superstition in old wives' tale still lived. Sometimes they gave orders, and they always spoke Italian when they did. Chetta believed that most people who worked in the arts were high-functioning schizophrenics, and she was no different. She knew superstition was shit. She also spat between her fingers if a crow or a black cat crossed her path. For much of her own schizophrenia, she had the Sisters of Mercy to thank. They believed in God. They believed in the divinity of Jesus. They believed mirrors were bewitching pools, and the child who looked into one too long would grow warts. These were the women who had been the greatest influence on her life between the ages of 7 and 12. They carried rulers in their belts for hitting, not measuring, and never saw a child's ear they did not desire to twist in passing. Lucy held out her arms for the baby. Chetta handed her over, not without reluctance. The kid was one sweet bundle.
2. 20 miles southeast of where Abra slept in Concetta Reynolds' arms, Dan Torrance was attending an AA meeting while some chick droned on about sex with her ex. Casey Kingsley had ordered him to attend 90 meetings in 90 days, and this one, a nooner in the basement of Fraser Methodist Church, was his 8th. He was sitting in the first row because Casey, known in the halls as Big Casey, had ordered him to do that, too.
Sick people who want to get well, sit in front, Danny. We call the back row at AA meetings the denial aisle.
Casey had given him a little notebook with a photo on the front that showed ocean waves crashing into a rock promontory. Printed above the picture was a motto Dan understood but didn't much care for. No great thing is created suddenly.
You write down every meeting you go to in that book, and any time I ask to see it, you better be able to haul it out of your back pocket and show me perfect attendance.
Don't I even get a sick day? Casey laughed.
You're sick every day, my friend. You're a drunk-ass alcoholic. Want to know something my sponsor told me?
I think you already did. You can't turn a pickle back into a cucumber, right?
Don't be a smart-ass. Just listen.
Dan sighed.
Listening.
Get your ass to a meeting, he said. If your ass falls off, put it in a bag and take it to a meeting.
Charming. What if I just forget?
Casey had shrugged. Then you find yourself another sponsor, one who believes in forgetfulness. I don't.
Dan, who felt like some breakable object that has skittered to the edge of a high shelf but hasn't quite fallen off, didn't want another sponsor or changes of any kind.
He felt okay, but tender. Very tender. Almost skinless. The visions that had plagued him following his arrival in Frasier had ceased, and although he often thought of Deanie and her little boy, the thoughts were not as painful. At the end of almost every AA meeting, someone read the promises. One of these was, "We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it." Dan thought he would always regret the past, but he had quit trying to shut the door. Why bother when it would just come open again? The fucking thing had no latch, let alone a lock. Now, he began to print a single word on the current page of the little book Casey had given him. He made large, careful letters. He had no idea why he was doing it or what it meant. The word was Abra. Meanwhile, the speaker reached the end of her qualification and burst into tears, through them declaring that even though her ex was a shit and she loved him still, she was grateful to be straight and sober. Dan applauded along with the rest of the lunch bunch, then began to color in the letters with his pen, fattening them, making them stand out. "Do I know this name? I think I do." As the next speaker began and he went to the urn for a fresh cup of coffee, it came to him. Abra was the name of a girl in a John Steinbeck novel, East of Eden. He'd read it. He couldn't remember where. At some stop along the way. Somewhere. It didn't matter. Another thought, "Did you save it?" rose to the top of his mind like a bubble and popped. Save what? Frankie P., the lunch bunch old-timer who was chairing the meeting, asked if someone wanted to do the Chip Club. When no one raised a hand, Frankie pointed, "How about you, lurking back there by the coffee?" Feeling self-conscious, Dan walked to the front of the room, hoping he could remember the order of the chips. The first, white for beginners, he had. As he took the battered cookie tin with the chips and medallions scattered inside it, the thought came again. "Did you save it?" 3. That was the day the True Knot, which had been wintering at a KOA campground in Arizona, packed up and began meandering back east. They drove along Route 77 towards Sholo in the usual caravan. 14 campers, some towing cars, some with lawn chairs or bicycles clamped to the backs. There were south winds and Winnebagos, Monacos and Bounders. Rose's Earth Cruiser, $700,000 worth of imported rolling steel, the best RV money could buy, led the parade. But slowly, just double-nickeling it. They were in no hurry. There was plenty of time. The feast was still months away. 4. "Did you save it?" Conchetta asked as Lucy opened her blouse and offered Abra the breast. Abby blinked sleepily, rooted a little, then lost interest. "Once your nipples get sore, you won't offer until she asks," Chetta thought, "and at the top of her lungs." "Save what?" David asked. Lucy knew.
"I passed out right after they put her in my arms. Dave says I almost dropped her. There was no time, Momo."
"Oh, that goop over her face," David said it dismissively. "They stripped it off and threw it away. Damn good thing, if you ask me."
He was smiling, but his eyes challenged her. "You know better than to go on with this," they said. "You know better, so just drop it." She did know better, and didn't. Had she been this two-minded when she was younger? She couldn't remember. Although it seemed she could remember every lecture on the blessed mysteries and the everlasting pain of hell administered by the Sisters of Mercy, those banditti in black. The story of the girl who had been struck blind for peeping at her brother while he was naked in the tub, and the one about the man who had been struck dead for blaspheming against the Pope. "Give them to us when they're young, and it doesn't matter how many honors classes they've taught, or how many books of poetry they've written,"
or even that one of those books won all the big prizes. Give them to us when they're young, and they're ours forever.
You should have saved Il Amnio. It's good luck. She spoke directly to her granddaughter, cutting David out entirely. He was a good man, a good husband to her Lucia, but fuck his dismissive tone, and double fuck his challenging eyes.
I would have, but I didn't have a chance, Momo, and Dave didn't know,
buttoning her blouse again. Chetta leaned forward and touched the fine skin of Abra's cheek with the tip of her finger, old flesh sliding across new.
Those born with El Amnio are supposed to have double sight.
You don't actually believe that, do you?
David asked. A call is nothing but a scrap of fetal membrane, it...
He was saying more, but Concetta paid no attention. Abra had opened her eyes. In them was a universe of poetry, lines too great to ever be written, or even remembered.
Never mind, Concetta said. She raised the baby and kissed the smooth skull where the fontanelle pulsed, the magic of the mind so close beneath. What's done is done.
5. One night, about 5 months after the not-quite argument over Abra's call, Lucy dreamed her daughter was crying, crying as if her heart would break. In this dream, Abby was no longer in the master bedroom of the house on Richland Court, but somewhere down a long corridor. Lucy ran in the direction of the weeping. At first there were doors on both sides, then seats. Blue ones, with high backs. She was on a plane, or maybe an Amtrak train. After running for what seemed like miles, she came to a bathroom door. Her baby was crying behind it. Not a hungry cry, but a frightened cry. Maybe, oh God, oh Mary, a hurt cry. Lucy was terribly afraid the door would be locked and she would have to break it down. Wasn't that the kind of thing that always happened in bad dreams? But the knob twisted, and she opened it. As she did, a new fear struck her. What if Abra was in the toilet? You read about that happening. Babies in toilets, babies in dumpsters. What if she were drowning in one of those ugly steel bowls they had on public conveyances up to her mouth and nose in disinfected blue water? But Abra lay on the floor. She was naked. Her eyes, swimming with tears, stared at her mother. Written on her chest, in what looked like blood, was the number 11.
6.
David Stone dreamed he was chasing his daughter's cries up an endless escalator that was running, slowly but inexorably, in the wrong direction. Worse, the escalator was in a mall, and the mall was on fire. He should have been choking and out of breath long before he reached the top, but there was no smoke from the fire, only a hell of flames. Nor was there any sound other than Abra's cries, although he saw people burning like kerosene-soaked torches. When he finally made it to the top, he saw Abby lying on the floor like someone's cast-off garbage. Men and women ran all around her, unheeding, and in spite of the flames, no one tried to use the escalator even though it was going down. They simply sprinted aimlessly in all directions, like ants whose hill has been torn open by a farmer's harrow. One woman in stilettos almost stepped on his daughter, a thing that would almost surely have killed her. Abra was naked. Written on her chest was the number 175.
7. The Stones woke together, both initially convinced that the cries they heard were a remnant of the dreams they had been having. But no, the cries were in the room with them.
Abby lay in her crib beneath her Shrek-mobile, eyes wide, cheeks red, tiny fists pumping, howling her head off. A change of diapers did not quiet her, nor did the breast, nor did what felt like miles of laps up and down the hall and at least 1,000 verses of The Wheels on the Bus. At last, very frightened now,
Abby was her first, and Lucy was at her wit's end. She called Concetta in Boston. Although it was 2 in the morning, Momo answered on the second ring. She was 85, and her sleep was as thin as her skin. She listened more closely to her wailing great-granddaughter than to Lucy's confused recital of all the ordinary remedies they had tried, then asked the pertinent questions. Is she running a fever? Pulling at one of her ears? Jerking her legs like she has to make merda? No, Lucy said, none of that. She's a little warm from crying, but I don't think it's a fever. Momo, what should I do?
Chetta, now sitting at her desk, didn't hesitate.
Give her another 15 minutes. If she doesn't quiet and begin feeding, take her to the hospital.
What? Brigham and Women's?
Confused and upset, it was all Lucy could think of. It was where she had given birth. That's 150 miles!
No, no.
Bridgeton. Across the border in Maine. That's a little closer than CNH.
Are you sure?
Am I looking at my computer right now?
Abra did not quiet. The crying was monotonous, maddening, terrifying.
When they arrived at Bridgeton Hospital, it was 4:15, and Abra was still at full volume. Rides in the Acura were usually better than a sleeping pill, but not this morning. David thought about brain aneurysms and told himself he was out of his mind. Babies didn't have strokes, did they?
Davy?
Lucy asked in a small voice as they pulled up to the sign reading emergency drop-off only.
Babies don't have strokes or heart attacks, do they?
No, I'm sure they don't.
But a new idea occurred to him then. Suppose the kiddo had somehow swallowed a safety pin, and it had popped open in her stomach. That's stupid. We use Huggies. She's never even been near a safety pin. Something else, then. A bobby pin from Lucy's hair. An errant tack that had fallen into the crib. Maybe even, God help them, a broken-off piece of plastic from Shrek, Donkey, or Princess Fiona.
Davy, what are you thinking?
Nothing.
The mobile was fine, he was sure of it. Almost sure.
Abra continued to scream.
8. David hoped the doc on duty would give his daughter a sedative, but it was against protocol for infants who could not be diagnosed, and Abra Rafaela Stone seemed to have nothing wrong with her. She wasn't running a fever. She wasn't showing a rash. An ultrasound had ruled out pyloric stenosis. An X-ray showed no foreign objects in her throat or stomach or a bowel obstruction. Basically, she just wouldn't shut up. The Stones were the only patients in the ER at that hour on a Tuesday morning, and each of the 3 nurses on duty had a try at quieting her. Nothing worked.
"Shouldn't you give her something to eat?" Lucy asked the doctor when he came back to check.
The phrase, "ringer's lactate," occurred to her, something she'd heard on one of the doctor's shows she'd watched ever since her teenage crush on George Clooney. But for all she knew, ringer's lactate was foot lotion, or an anticoagulant, or something for stomach ulcers. She won't take the breast or the bottle.
When she gets hungry enough, she'll eat, the doctor said,
but neither Lucy nor David was much comforted. For one thing, the doctor looked younger than they were. For another, this was far worse, he didn't sound completely sure.
Have you called your pediatrician? He checked the paperwork. Dr. Dalton?
Left a message with his service, David said. We probably won't hear from him until mid-morning, and by then this will be over. One way or the other, he thought, and his mind, made ungovernable by too little sleep and too much anxiety, presented him with a picture as clear as it was horrifying. Mourners standing around a small grave, and an even smaller coffin.
9. At 7:30... Cheddar Reynolds blew into the examining room where the Stones and their ceaselessly screaming baby daughter had been stashed. The poet, rumored to be on the short list for a Presidential Medal of Freedom, was dressed in straight-leg jeans and a BU sweatshirt with a hole in one elbow. The outfit showed just how thin she'd become over the last 3 or 4 years.
No cancer, if that's what you're thinking, she'd say if anyone commented on her runway model thinness, which she ordinarily disguised with billowing dresses or caftans. I'm just in training for the final lap around the track.
Her hair, as a rule braided or put up in complicated swoops arranged to showcase her collection of vintage hair clips, stood out around her head in an unkempt Einstein cloud. She wore no makeup, and even in her distress, Lucy was shocked by how old Conchetta looked. Well, of course she was old. 85 was very old, but until this morning she had looked like a woman in her late 60s at most.
I would have been here an hour earlier if I'd found someone to come in and take care of Betty.
Betty was her elderly, ailing boxer.
Chetta caught David's reproachful glance.
Betts is dying, David, and based on what you could tell me over the phone, I wasn't all that concerned about Abra.
Are you concerned now? David asked.
Lucy flashed him a warning glance, but Chetta seemed willing to accept the implied rebuke.
Yes. She held out her hands.
Give her to me, Lucy.
Let's see if she'll quiet for Momo.
But Abra would not quiet for Momo, no matter how she was rocked. Nor did a soft and surprisingly tuneful lullaby, for all David knew it was the wheels on the bus in Italian, do the job. They all tried the walking cure again, first squiring her around the small exam room, then down the hall, then back to the exam room. The screaming went on and on. At some point, there was a commotion outside. Someone with actual visible injuries being wheeled in, David assumed, but those in exam room 4 took little notice. At 8:55, the exam room door opened and the Stones pediatrician walked in. Dr. John Dalton was a fellow Dan Torrance would have recognized, although not by last name. To Dan, he was just Dr. John, who made the coffee at the Thursday night big book meeting in North Conway.
"Thank God,"
Lucy said, thrusting her howling child into the pediatrician's arms.
"We've been left on our own for hours."
I was on my way when I got the message.
Dalton hoisted Abra onto his shoulder.
"Rounds here, then over in Castle Rock. You've heard about what's happened, haven't you?"
"Heard what?" David asked. With the door open, he was for the first time consciously aware of a moderate uproar outside. People were talking in loud voices. Some were crying. The nurse who had admitted them walked by, her face red and blotchy, her cheeks wet. She didn't even glance at the screaming infant.
"A passenger jet hit the World Trade Center," Dalton said, "and no one thinks it was an accident."
That was American Airlines Flight 11. United Airlines Flight 175 struck the Trade Center's South Tower 17 minutes later at 9:03 a.m. At 9:03, Abra Stone abruptly stopped crying. By 9:04, she was sound asleep. On their ride back to Anniston, David and Lucy listened to the radio while Abra slept peacefully in her car seat behind them. The news was unbearable. But turning it off was unthinkable, at least until a newscaster announced the names of the airlines and the flight numbers of the aircraft. 2 in New York, 1 near Washington, 1 cratered in rural Pennsylvania. Then David finally reached over and silenced the flood of disaster. "Lucy, I have to tell you something. I dreamed..." "I know." She spoke in the flat tone of one who has just suffered a shock. "So did I." By the time they crossed back into New Hampshire, David had begun to believe there might be something to that call business, after all.
10. In a New Jersey town on the west bank of the Hudson River, there's a park named for the town's most famous resident. On a clear day, it offers a perfect view of Lower Manhattan. The True Knot arrived in Hoboken on September 8th, parking in a private lot which they had four-walled for 10 days. Crowdaddy did the deal. Handsome and gregarious, looking about 40, Crow's favorite T-shirt read, "I'm a people person." Not that he ever wore a T when negotiating for the True Knot, then it was strictly suit and tie. It was what the Rubes expected. His straight name was Henry Rothman. He was a Harvard-educated lawyer, class of 38, and he always carried cash.
The True had over $1 billion in various accounts across the world, some in gold, some in diamonds, some in rare books, stamps, and paintings, but never paid by check or credit card. Everyone, even P and Pod, who looked like kids, carried a roll of 10s and 20s.
As Jimmy Numbers had once said, "We're a cash-and-carry outfit. We pay cash, and the rubes carry us."
Jimmy was the True's accountant. In his rube days, he had once ridden with an outfit that became known, long after their war was over, as Quantrill's Raiders. Back then, he had been a wild kid who wore a buffalo coat and carried a Sharps, but in the years since, he had mellowed. These days, he had a framed, autographed picture of Ronald Reagan in his RV. On the morning of September 11th, the True watched the attacks on the Twin Towers from the parking lot, passing around 4 pairs of binoculars. They would have had a better view from Sinatra Park, but Rose didn't need to tell them that gathering early might attract suspicion. And in the months and years ahead, America was going to be a very suspicious nation. If you see something, say something. Around 10 that morning, when crowds had gathered all along the riverbank and it was safe, they made their way to the park. The little twins, P and Pod, pushed Grandpa Flick in his wheelchair. Grandpa wore his cap stating, "I am a vet." His long, baby-fine white hair floated around the cap's edges like milkweed. There had been a time when he'd told folks he was a veteran of the Spanish-American War. Then it was World War I. Nowadays, it was World War II. In another 20 years or so, he expected to switch his story to Vietnam. Verisimilitude had never been a problem. Grandpa was a military history buff. Sinatra Park was jammed. Most folks were silent, but some wept. Apron Annie and Black-Eyed Sue helped in this respect. Both were able to cry on demand. The others put on suitable expressions of sorrow, solemnity, and amazement. Basically, the True Knot fit right in. It was how they rolled. Spectators came and went, but the True stayed for most of the day, which was cloudless and beautiful, except for the thick billows of dreck rising in lower Manhattan, that is. They stood at the iron rail, not talking among themselves, just watching, and taking long, slow, deep breaths, like tourists from the Midwest standing for the first time on Pemaquid Point or Quoddy Head in Maine, breathing deep of the fresh sea air. As a sign of respect, Rose took off her top hat and held it by her side. At 4 o'clock, they trooped back to their encampment in the parking lot, invigorated. They would return the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that. They would return until the good steam was exhausted, and then they would move on again. By then, Grandpa Flick's white hair would have become iron gray, and he would no longer need the wheelchair. Chapter 3. Spoons. 1. It was a 20-mile drive from Fraser to North Conway, but Dan Torrance made it every Thursday night, partly because he could. He was now working at Helen Rivington House, making a decent salary, and he had his driver's license back. The car he'd bought to go with it wasn't much, just a 3-year-old Caprice with black wall tires and an iffy radio, but the engine was good, and every time he started it up, he felt like the luckiest man in New Hampshire. He thought if he never had to ride another bus, he could die happy. It was January of 2004. Except for a few random thoughts and images, plus the extra work he sometimes did at the hospice, of course, The Shining had been quiet. He would have done that volunteer work in any case, but after his time in AA, he also saw it as making amends, which recovering people considered almost as important as staying away from the first drink. If he could manage to keep the plug in the jug another 3 months, he would be able to celebrate 3 years sober. Driving, again, figured large in the daily gratitude meditations upon which Casey Kay insisted,
Because, he said, and with all the dour certainty of the program long-timer, a grateful alcoholic doesn't get drunk.
But mostly Dan went on Thursday nights because the big book gathering was soothing. Intimate, really. Some of the open discussion meetings in the area were uncomfortably large, but that was never true on Thursday nights in North Conway. There was an old AA saying that went, "If you want to hide something from an alcoholic, stick it in the big book." And attendance at the North Conway Thursday night meeting suggested that there was some truth in it. Even during the weeks between the 4th of July and Labor Day, the height of the tourist season, it was rare to have more than a dozen people in the AmVets hall when the gavel fell. As a result, Dan had heard things he suspected would never have been spoken aloud in the meetings that drew 50 or even 70 recovering alkies and druggies. In those, speakers had a tendency to take refuge in the platitudes, of which there were hundreds, and avoid the personal. You'd hear, "Serenity pays dividends," and, "You can take my inventory if you're willing to make my amends," but never, "I fucked my brother's wife one night when we were both drunk." At the Thursday night We Study Sobriety meetings, the little enclave read Bill Wilson's big blue how-to manual from cover to cover, each new meeting picking up where the last meeting had left off. When they got to the end of the book, they went back to the doctor's statement and started all over again. Most meetings covered 10 pages or so. That took about half an hour. In the remaining half hour, the group was supposed to talk about the material just read. Sometimes they actually did. Quite often, however, the discussion veered off in other directions, like an unruly planchette scurrying around a Ouija board beneath the fingers of neurotic teenagers. Dan remembered a Thursday night meeting he'd attended when he was about 8 months sober. The chapter under discussion, "To Wives," was full of antique assumptions that almost always provoked a hot response from the younger women in the program. They wanted to know why, in the 65 years or so since the big book's original publication, no one had ever added a chapter called "To Husbands." When Gemma T., a 30-something whose only two emotional settings seemed to be angry and profoundly pissed off, raised her hand on that particular night, Dan had expected a fem-lib tirade. Instead, she said, much more quietly than usual,
"I need to share something. I've been holding on to it ever since I was 17, and unless I let go, I'll never be able to stay away from coke and wine."
The group waited.
"I hit a man with my car when I was coming home drunk from a party," Gemma said. "This was back in Somerville. I left him lying by the side of the road. I didn't know if he was dead or alive. I still don't. I waited for the cops to come and arrest me, but they never did. I got away with it."
She had laughed at this the way people do when the joke's an especially good one, then put her head down on the table and burst into sobs so deep that they shook her rail-thin body. It had been Dan's first experience with how terrifying honesty in all our affairs could be when it was actually put into practice. He thought, as he still did every so often, of how he had stripped Deanie's wallet of cash, and how the little boy had reached for the cocaine on the coffee table. He was a little in awe of Gemma, but that much raw honesty wasn't in him. If it came down to a choice between telling that story and taking a drink, I'd take the drink, no question.
2. Tonight the reading was Gutter Bravado, one of the stories from the section of the big book cheerily titled, "They Lost Nearly All." The tale followed a pattern with which Dan had become familiar. Good family, church on Sundays, first drink, first binge, business success spoiled by booze, escalating lies, first arrest, broken promises to reform, institutionalization, and the final happy ending. All the stories in the big book had happy endings. That was part of its charm. It was a cold night, but overwarm inside, and Dan was edging into a doze when Dr. John raised his hand and said,
"I've been lying to my wife about something, and I don't know how to stop."
That woke Dan up,
He liked DJ a lot.
It turned out that John's wife had given him a watch for Christmas, quite an expensive one, and when she had asked him a couple of nights ago why he wasn't wearing it, John said he'd left it at the office.
"Only it's not there. I looked everywhere, and it's just not. I do a lot of hospital rounds, and if I have to change into scrubs, I use one of the lockers in the doctor's lounge. There are combo locks, but I hardly ever use them because I don't carry much cash and I don't have anything else worth stealing. Except for the watch, I guess. I can't remember taking it off and leaving it in a locker, not at C&H or over in Bridgeton, but I think I must have. It's not the expense. It just brings back a lot of the old stuff from the days when I was drinking myself stupid every night and chipping speed the next morning to get going." They were nodding heads at this, followed by similar stories of guilt-driven deceit. No one gave advice. That was called crosstalk and frowned on. They simply told their tales. John listened with his head down and his hands clasped between his knees. After the basket was passed, "We are self-supporting through our own contributions,"
he thanked everyone for their input. From the look of him, Dan didn't think said input had helped a whole hell of a lot.
After the Lord's Prayer, Dan put away the leftover cookies and stacked the group's tattered big books in the cabinet marked "For AA Use."
A few people were still hanging around the butt can outside, the so-called meeting after the meeting, but he and John had the kitchen to themselves. Dan hadn't spoken during the discussion. He was too busy having an interior debate with himself. The Shining had been quiet, but that didn't mean it was absent. He knew from his volunteer work that it was actually stronger than it had been since childhood, though now he seemed to have a greater degree of control over it. That made it less frightening and more useful. His co-workers at Rivington House knew he had something, but most of them called it empathy and let it go at that. The last thing he wanted now that his life had begun to settle down was to get a reputation as some sort of parlor psychic. Best to keep the freaky shit to himself. Dr. John was a good guy, though, and he was hurting. DJ placed the coffee urn upside down in the dish drainer, used a length of towel hanging from the stove handle to dry his hands, then turned to Dan, offering a smile that looked as real as the coffee mate Dan had stored away next to the cookies in the sugar bowl.
"Well, I'm off. See you next week, I guess."
In the end, the decision made itself. Dan simply could not let the guy go looking like that. He held his arms out. "Give it up." The fabled AA man hug. Dan had seen many, but never given a single one. John looked dubious for a moment, then stepped forward. Dan drew him in, thinking, "There'll probably be nothing." But there was. It came as quickly as it had when, as a child, he had sometimes helped his mother and father find lost things. "Listen to me, Doc," he said, letting John go. "You were worried about the kid with the Goochers." John stepped back.
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm not saying it right. I know that. Goochers? Glutchers? It's some sort of bone thing."
John's mouth dropped open. "Are you talking about Norman Lloyd?"
"You tell me."
"Normie's got Gaucher's disease. It's a lipid disorder. Hereditary and very rare. Causes an enlarged spleen, neurological disorders, and usually an early unpleasant death. Poor kid's basically got a glass skeleton, and he'll probably die before he's 10.
"But how do you know that?"
"From his parents. The Lloyds live way the hell down in Nashua."
"You were worried about talking to him. The terminal ones drive you crazy. That's why you stopped in the Tigger bathroom to wash your hands, even though your hands didn't need washing. You took off your watch and put it up on the shelf where they keep that dark red disinfectant shit that comes in the plastic squeeze bottles. I don't know the name." John D. was staring at him as though he had gone mad. "Which hospital is this kid in?" Dan asked.
"Elliot. The time frame's about right.
and I did stop in the bathroom near the Peds nursing station to wash my hands. He paused, frowning.
And yeah, I guess there are Milne characters on the wall in that one. But if I'd taken off my watch, I'd remember...
He trailed off. You do remember, Dan said and smiled. Now you do, don't you? John said,
I checked the Elliot Lost and Found. Bridgeton and C&H, too, for that matter. Nothing.
Okay, so maybe somebody came along, saw it, and stole it. If so, you're shit out of luck. But at least you can tell your wife what happened. And why it happened. You were thinking about the kid. Worrying about the kid. And you forgot to put your watch back on before you left the can. Simple as that. And hey, maybe it's still there. That's a high shelf and hardly anybody uses what's in those plastic bottles because there's a soap dispenser right beside the sink.
It's betadine on that shelf, John said. And up high, so the kids can't reach it. I never noticed, but... Dan, have you ever been in Elliot?
This wasn't a question he wanted to answer. Just check the shelf, Doc. Maybe you'll get lucky.
3. Dan arrived early at the following Thursday's We Study Sobriety meeting. If Dr. John had decided to trash his marriage and possibly his career over a missing $700 watch, alkies routinely trashed marriages and careers over far less, someone would have to make the coffee. But John was there. So was the watch. This time, it was John who initiated the man hug. An extremely hearty one. Dan almost expected to receive a pair of Gallic kisses on the cheeks before DJ let him go.
It was right where you said it would be. 10 days and still there. It's like a miracle.
Nah, Dan said. Most people rarely look above their own eyeline. It's a proven fact.
How did you know?
Dan shook his head. I can't explain it. Sometimes I just do.
How can I thank you?
This was the question Dan had been waiting and hoping for. By working the 12th step, dummix.
John D. raised his eyebrows.
Anonymity. In words of one syllable, keep your fucking mouth shut.
Understanding broke on John's face. He grinned.
I can do that.
Good. Now make the coffee. I'll put out the books.
4. In most New England AA groups, anniversaries are called birthdays and celebrated with a cake and an after-meeting party. Shortly before Dan was due to celebrate his 3rd year of sobriety in this fashion, David Stone and Abra's great-grandmother came to see John Dalton, known in some circles as either Dr. John or DJ, and invite him to another 3rd birthday party. This was the one the Stones were throwing for Abra.
That's very kind, John said, and I'll be more than happy to drop by if I can. Only, why do I feel there's a little more to it?
Because there is, Chetta said.
And Mr. Stubborn here has decided that it's finally time to talk about it. Is there a problem with Abra? If there is, fill me in. Based on her last checkup, she's fine. Fearsomely bright. Social skills, terrific. Verbal skills, through the roof. Reading, ditto. Last time she was here, she read me alligators all around. Probably rote memory, but still remarkable for a child who's not yet 3.
Does Lucy know you're here?
Lucy and Chetta are the ones who ganged up on me, David said. Lucy's home with Abra making cupcakes for the party. When I left, the kitchen looked like hell in a high wind.
So what are we saying here? That you want me at her party in an observational capacity?
That's right. Conchetta said. None of us can say for sure that something will happen, but it's more likely to when she's excited, and she's very excited about her party. All her little pals from daycare are coming, and there's going to be a fellow who does magic tricks.
John opened a desk drawer and took out a yellow legal pad.
What kind of something are you expecting?
David hesitated.
That's hard to say.
Chetta turned to face him.
Go on, Carl. Too late to back out now.
Her tone was light,
almost gay, but John Dalton thought she looked worried. He thought they both did.
"Begin with the night," she started crying and wouldn't stop.
5. David Stone had been teaching American history and 20th century European history to undergraduates for 10 years and knew how to organize a story, so the interior logic was hard to miss. He began this one by pointing out that their infant daughter's marathon crying spree had ended almost immediately after the second jetliner had struck the World Trade Center. Then he doubled back to the dreams in which his wife had seen the American Airlines flight number on Abra's chest and he had seen the United Airlines number. In Lucy's dream, she found Abra in an airplane bathroom. In mine, I found her in a mall that was on fire. Draw your own conclusions about that part. Or not. To me, those flight numbers seem pretty conclusive, but of what, I don't know. He laughed without much humor, raised his hands, then dropped them again. Maybe I'm afraid to know. John Dalton remembered the morning of 9/11 and Abra's non-stop crying jag very well.
Let me get this straight. You believe your daughter, who was then only 5 months old, had a premonition of those attacks and somehow sent word to you, telepathically?
Yes, Chetta said.
Put very succinctly. Bravo.
I know how it sounds, David said, which is why Lucy and I kept it to ourselves. Except for Chetta, that is. Lucy told her that night.
Lucy tells her Momo everything.
He sighed. Conchetta gave him a cool look.
You didn't get one of these dreams? John asked her.
She shook her head.
I was in Boston. Out of her,
I don't know,
transmitting range?
It's been almost 3 years since 9/11, John said. I assume other stuff has happened since then.
A lot of other stuff had happened, and now that he had managed to speak of the first and most unbelievable thing, Dave found himself able to talk about the rest easily enough.
The piano. That was next. You know Lucy plays?
John shook his head.
Well, she does. Since she was in grammar school. She's not great or anything, but she's pretty good. We've got a Vogel that my parents gave her as a wedding present. It's in the living room, which is also where Abra's playpen used to be.
Well, one of the presents I gave Lucy for Christmas in 2001 was a book of Beatles tunes arranged for piano. Abra used to lie in her playpen, goofing with her toys and listening. You could tell by the way she smiled and kicked her feet that she liked the music.
John didn't question this. Most babies loved music, and they had their ways of letting you know.
The book had all the hits. Hey Jude, Lady Madonna, Let It Be. But the one Abra liked best was one of the minor songs, a B-side called Not a Second Time. Do you know it?
Not offhand, John said. I might if I heard it.
It's upbeat, but unlike most of the Beatles' fast stuff, it's built around a piano riff rather than the usual guitar sound. It isn't a boogie-woogie, but close.
Abra loved it. She wouldn't just kick her feet when Lucy played that one. She'd actually bicycle them.
Dave smiled at the memory of Abra on her back in her bright purple onesie, not yet able to walk, but crib dancing like a disco queen.
The instrumental break is almost all piano, and it's simple as pie. The left hand just picks out the notes. There are only 29, I counted. A kid could play it, and our kid did.
John raised his eyebrows until they almost met his hairline.
It started in the spring of 2002. Lucy and I were in bed, reading. The weather report was on TV, and that comes about halfway through the 11 p.m. newscast. Abra was in her room, fast asleep, as far as we knew. Lucy asked me to turn off the TV because she wanted to go to sleep. I clicked the remote, and that's when we heard it. The piano break of Not a Second Time. Those 29 notes. Perfect. Not a single miss. And coming from downstairs.
Doc, we were scared shitless.
We thought we had an intruder in the house, only what kind of burglar stops to play a little Beatles before grabbing the silverware? I don't have a gun, and my golf clubs were in the garage, so I just picked up the biggest book I could find and went down to confront whoever was there. Pretty stupid, I know. I told Lucy to grab the phone and dial 911 if I yelled, but there was no one, and all the doors were locked. Also, the cover was down over the piano keys. I went back upstairs and told Lucy I hadn't found anything or anyone. We went down the hall to check the baby. We didn't talk about it, we just did it. I think we knew it was Abra, but neither of us wanted to say it right out loud. She was awake, just lying there in her crib and looking at us. You know the wise little eyes that they have? John knew, as if they could tell you all the secrets of the universe if they were only able to talk. There were times when he thought that might even be so. Only God had arranged things in such a way so that by the time they could get beyond Goo Goo Gaga, they had forgotten it all, the way we forget even our most vivid dreams a couple of hours after waking. She smiled when she saw us, closed her eyes, and dropped off. The next night, it happened again. Same time. Those 29 notes from the living room. Then silence. Then down to Abra's room and finding her awake. Not fussing, not even sucking her bink, just looking at us through the bars of her crib, then off to sleep. "This is the truth," John said, not really questioning, only wanting to get it straight. "You're not pulling my leg." David didn't smile. "Not even twitching the cuff of your pants." John turned to Chetta. "Have you heard it yourself?"
"No. Let David finish." "We got a couple of nights off, and you know how you say that the secret of successful parenting is always make a plan?"
"Sure." This was John Dalton's chief sermon to new parents. "How are you going to handle night feedings? Draw up a schedule so someone's always on call and no one gets too ragged. How are you going to handle bathing and feeding and dressing and playtime so the kid has a regular and hence comforting routine? Draw up a schedule, make a plan. Do you know how to handle an emergency? Anything from a collapsed crib to a choking incident? If you make a plan, you will. And 19 times out of 20, things will turn out fine."
So that's what we did. For the next 3 nights, I slept on the sofa right across from the piano. On the third night, the music started just as I was snugging down for the night. The cover on the Vogel was closed, so I hustled over and raised it. The keys weren't moving, which didn't surprise me much because I could tell the music wasn't coming from the piano.
"Beg pardon?"
"It was coming from above it, from thin air." By then, Lucy was in Abra's room. The other times we hadn't said anything, we were too stunned, but this time she was ready. She told Abra to play it again. There was a little pause, and then she did. I was standing so close, I almost could have snatched those notes out of the air. Silence in John Dalton's office. He had stopped writing on the pad. Chetta was looking at him gravely. At last he said,
"Is this still going on?"
"No." Lucy took Abra on her lap and told her not to play any more at night because we couldn't sleep. And that was the end of it. He paused to consider. "Almost the end. Once, about 3 weeks later, we heard the music again, but very soft and coming from upstairs this time, from her room."
"She was playing to herself," Conchetta said. "She woke up. She couldn't get back to sleep right away, so she played herself a little lullaby."
6.
One Monday afternoon, just about a year after the fall of the Twin Towers, Abra, walking by now and with recognizable words beginning to emerge from her all but constant gabble, teetered her way to the front door and plopped down there with her favorite doll in her lap. "What you doing, sweetheart?" Lucy asked. She was sitting at the piano playing a Scott Joplin rag. "Dada," Abra announced.
"Honey, Dada won't be home until supper," Lucy said. But 15 minutes later, the Acura pulled up the drive and Dave got out, hauling his briefcase. There had been a water main break.